Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. This is John Schaefer. John works in a building where the elevators have those little information screens that give you weather and headlines and stuff. And today, on the way up, the elevator screen told John that talking about yourself in the third person, or self-distancing as they termed it, can actually relieve stress in challenging situations. John's not so sure about that. He's kind of afraid he'll end up sounding like an old episode of Seinfeld. But John's willing to try it because today's show might actually be a challenge. First, we have a Pick 3 playlist from novelist Francine Prose that includes a song that John absolutely hates, though he really likes her acclaimed new novel called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932. So, John will talk with her, but he's also going to speak with vocalist Meredith Graves and her band Perfect Pussy. Now, John's heard the wall of noise that the band produces, and quite frankly, he's a little afraid of her. But John likes how she and the band find inspiration in that old hardcore tradition that says, don't let anyone tell you what to do or how to be. So why am I letting an elevator tell me what to do and how to talk about myself? Okay, enough of the third-person self-distancing thing. Let's start with an in-studio performance from Casey Dinell, a classically trained pianist who records under the name White Hinterland. Her latest album looks not to Bach, but to R&B and soul. We'll talk with her later on the show, but first, here is White Hinterland performing the song Metronome, live on Soundcheck.
Metronome, metronome.
Thank you.
That's Casey Dinell, the keyboardist, singer, and songwriter better known as White Hinterland. That song's called Metronome, performed here in the Soundcheck studio, and we'll have more from White Hinterland coming up later on the show.
Three, that's a magic number.
Three.
It is. It's the magic number.
Joining us for today's Pick 3 playlist is the author Francine Prose. Her new book is called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It is a jam-packed story about good and evil, love gone bad, race cars, Hitler, Picasso, photography, bad cops, crazy escapes, and one very troubled woman. Francine Prose, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
So this story of yours is told kind of Rashomon style by five different narrators, all revolving around this place, the Chameleon Club.
Mm-hmm.
That was inspired by a real club, right?
Yeah. The real club was called Le Monocle, the Monocle, and it existed in Paris in the 20s and 30s. It was a cross-dressers club. And a lot of the stuff that happened there I just made up because it was so much fun. You know, do the programming for a cross-dressers club in Paris in the 30s. What could be more fun? The acts, the music, and so forth. And surprisingly, it stuck around. I mean, it lasted all the way through the war. And then I sort of lost track of it because of, you know, the book ended. But I was just reading a biography of Jane Bowles, and she used to go there in the 50s. So it was still there.
Hmm.
So
when you started writing this, did you intend it to be a work of nonfiction?
At the very beginning. I mean, I'd seen the Brassai photograph of the two women sitting in the bar. And one of the women is wearing a spangly evening dress. The other is cross-dresser in a tuxedo. And what I found out...
And then this was actually taken at that club, the
Monocle.
This
was taken at that club, yeah. And what I found out was that the woman in the tuxedo, all I knew from the wall text at the photo show, had gone to work for the Gestapo when France was occupied by the Nazis. So I went online and I did the research, and it turned out, what I could find out, her real name was Violette Morris. She'd been a professional athlete, shot putter, race car driver. And in 1935, the French government took away her license to compete professionally because she was a cross-dresser, which turned out to be in violation of the Napoleonic Code. Who knew why? And Hitler found out about it and invited her to be his special guest at the 36th Berlin Olympics. She went to the Berlin Olympics as Hitler's guest. By the time she got back to France, she was not only spying for the Germans, but she told them where the Maginot Line ended. She did go to
that's
work.
Where that's the fortified line.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
There to
I mean, of course,
France.
Anyone could have told them where the Maginot Line, but she gets credit.
But she's the one who did it.
And then she did go to work for the Gestapo, and she was assassinated by the resistance in 1944. So I had that was all I could find out, and those were the dots that
that's
I had.
That's a lot.
Get.
That's a lot to find out.
I know, and again, you know, you can't make this stuff up. So I just had to connect those dots. So the novel came out of my efforts to make those things hook up.
And the real character of Violette Morris mm-hmm. becomes the fictional character of Lou Villar.
Yeah.
So in your research into the time and the period, how much listening did you do to the music that would have been heard in a club like this?
I downloaded several CDs of French cabaret music from the time. Now, some of it you can listen to and is still great. I mean, Edith Piaf, of course, is still fantastic. And some of it is pretty hard to listen to because that super nasal vocal style
yeah,
of the time,
yeah, yeah.
It really, I mean, that was the style. But you listen to it now and there's something kind of grating and weird about it. So, you know.
Now, Piaf, you know, would have been sort of towards the latter part of this period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the first song that you've chosen for us in your playlist is Mon Légionnaire, which is from the mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, the clouds are already darkening over Europe.
The clouds are darkening. And also Mon Légionnaire, I mean, there are other Edith Piaf songs that I like a lot better and that everyone likes a lot better. But Mon Légionnaire has a slightly nationalistic tinge to it, and so much of the music at that time became nationalistic or was divided up by so-called patriotism and so forth. So that was a very popular song at the time when France was becoming more and more nationalistic.
Let's hear it from the great French chanteuse Edith Piaf.
Il avait de grands yeux très clairs où parfois passaient des éclairs comme au ciel passent des orages. Il avait plein de tatouages que j'ai jamais avait très bien compris, son coup portait à vue pas pris. Sur son cœur on lisait personne, sur son bras droit un mot résonne. Je sais pas son nom, je ne sais rien de lui. Il m'a aimé toute la nuit, mon légionnaire. Mince, il était beau, il sentait bon le sable chaud. Mon légionnaire.
From the great French singer Edith Piaf, a song called Mon Légionnaire, chosen for us by the author Francine Prose. Her new book is called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, an epic kind of look back at a place and time, sort of like Weimar Germany, where people, Francine, are almost willfully blinkered in mm-hmm. their view of their world and their place in it, at, you know, to the exclusion of what's really on the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you're having a good time until everything comes crashing down around you. Wasn't that Piaf song beautiful? I mean, she was like Nina Simone in a way. You know, everything she sang, she just owned it. So.
Yeah. And kind of curious, the trumpet playing in the background, almost like a parody of a patriotic song.
I know. Well, I think there was a certain amount of saluting involved, too. So.
Now, Edith Piaf does not appear in your book, at least not... You know,
not directly. There's a reference to her. I mean, I do have a music hall singer who is a real right-wing maniac. And at some point, one of the narratives says, you know, she would hardly allow Edith Piaf on because she wanted to be the center of attention all the time. But no, she doesn't actually appear.
But Picasso does.
Picasso does.
Hitler does.
And Hitler does.
In a very unusual scene. And then there are thinly veiled versions of... One of the narrators is a kind of Henry Miller. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Hungarian photographer Brassai. Mm-hmm. One of the first narrator we meet is his alter ego. So, you know, the line between fantasy and fact here seems to be kind of intentionally blurry.
Mm-hmm.
How much are we supposed to be trying to parse that as readers?
Well, I just used as much as I absolutely had to from fact to make it believable. But there are certain things, you know, I did do a certain amount of research. And for example, there's a dinner party with Hitler scene. And there's a book that exists called Hitler's Table Talk. And Bormann, I mean, it's almost unreadable. It's so boring. Bormann wrote down everything that Hitler said at dinner for years. And it's 800 pages long. And Hitler went on at great length about his dietary preferences and his health and nutrition ideas. So I just was able to kind of take that directly and put it into the novel.
Right. What about, you know, there are various what look to be quotes of songs that are being performed at mm-hmm. the club, at the Chameleon Club, which when we looked them up online, we didn't get anything. So were you making up songs?
I was making up songs. There's one that's real. There's one called Madame la Marquise, and it's a woman who calls, who keeps calling home, and they keep saying, everything's fine, madame, but your house is burned down, your stable's burned down, your horses are dead, your husband committed suicide, but everything's fine.
But everything's fine.
And that's supposed to be a sort of parody or a comment on the time in which they were living. Everything's fine, except the house is burning down, the husband's dead, you know, everything's
right.
falling apart, but everything's fine.
So Hitler just invaded Poland, but you go ahead and finish that champagne.
Right.
Everything's
exactly.
fine. Did you have something, I mean, when you were making up these songs, were you hearing them in your mind? Did you...
Mm-hmm. It was so much fun. I mean, again, it was so much fun. I was making up the acts at this club. I mean, a friend sent me a clip of a three contortionist sisters from the 40s, like 50s maybe, and doing some song called, like, Solid Cold Potatoes. I can't remember. I mean, really crazy contortionist stuff. And I just took that and transposed it back to make one of the main acts be a bunch of quartet contortionists. But, you know, I did this kind of undersea act that runs all the way through this Neptune and a mermaid and a sailor, mm-hmm. a Little Mermaid act. And those were all made up. And again, how much fun, you know, just make up a bunch of cross-dressers, huge routines.
Well, now, one of your previous novels was made into a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Could somebody make this into a musical? And if so, would you be there saying, no, no, the song has to sound like this?
Well, I mean, I don't know about it. I mean, musicals, I mean, I love the musical they made of my novel, but musicals per se make me kind of nervous. You know, I always get sort of anxious when the characters start singing. But I don't know how you could do a movie of this without there being music in it, since so much of it takes place in a music hall.
So The Glorious Ones is the novel that was it was off-Broadway for a while. Francine Prose, her latest novel is called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, and she's sharing her Pick 3 playlist with us on Soundcheck today. Very famous song on your Pick 3, which is Maurice Chevalier's Thank Heaven for Little Girls. Now, this is later than the activity taking place in the novel. Is there a connection here?
Well, it's much later. But Chevalier was one of the many entertainers who had a slightly sketchy history of not exactly collaboration, but kept on more or less performing during the occupation, certainly did not come out against the occupiers. Certainly, I mean, unlike, for example, Josephine Baker, who was working for the resistance, he definitely was not. So right after the war, he was in mild disgrace for a while, and then that's kind of cleared up in time for him to sing Thank Heaven for Little Girls in Gigi, the movie.
Here it is. It's on Francine Prose's Pick 3 playlist for us today on Soundcheck.
Each time I see a little girl of 5 or 6 or 7, I can't resist a joyous urge to smile and say thank heaven for little girls. For little girls get bigger every day. Thank heaven for little girls. They grow up in the most delightful way. Those little eyes so helpless and appealing, one day will flash and send you crashing through the ceiling. Thank heaven for little girls. Thank heaven for them all, no matter where, no matter who. Without them, what would little boys do?
Well, thank heaven I don't have to hear any more of that.
It's a song you can imagine being sung by Humbert and Lolita.
Oh, my goodness.
Right? I know, a little hymn to pedophilia.
Francine Prose, that song is all kinds of wrong.
So terrible. I know.
But you picked it.
I picked it. I mean, it was not a song I was listening to writing the book, but it was something about the sketchy, skeezy moral quality of the time that I wanted to get in there.
Yeah. You know, the filmmaker Miyazaki, you know, recently retired, or so he claims. One of the things I've always loved about his films is he seems to love all of his characters, even the ostensibly bad ones. Mm-hmm. And people have sort of been reacting to the characters in this book the same way, that you seem to have a lot of sympathy, even for this central figure who is kind of transformed and twisted by her own life. I find it hard to listen to a song like that and find a lot of sympathy.
I know, I know. I know. Well, I'd have to write about it at great length, which I'm not going to do.
So do you listen to music when you're writing?
I do. I do. I can only listen to classical music, and preferably without words. Words are a problem.
Right.
So, and you know, it's their words versus my words. But I can listen. I listen a lot to Bach and Handel when I'm working. There's something about the and actually in those cases, I can listen to the oratorios and the St. Matthew Passion, partly because I know the pieces so well that I'm only listening partly. It's just partly kind of filling the room in my head with pleasant sounds.
Mm. But for this book, would you have been listening to that, you know, CD of old French chansons from the 20s and 30s?
When I was taking breaks, yeah.
Okay, right. But you couldn't actually write
when
while
I was actually writing,
that.
No. But when I was thinking about it, I was listening to it because I wanted, you know, I was trying to imagine myself back into that time and imagine, you know, I was looking at photographs, I was looking at clips on YouTube, and I was listening to the music just trying to get myself out of my study and into that other world.
And do you need to be in each character's head? I mean, especially in this book where you've got 5 sort of competing and at times conflicting narratives going, you know, you've got unreliable narrators and narrators whose reliability we might suspect. Are you in there in each of them?
That's the fun. I mean, I'm so sick of being me, you know. I mean, the great pleasure was going into my study, and I was not me. I was these other people. And, I mean, the fact that the Henry Miller character was the easiest one to write was kind of scary for, you know, my getting in touch with my inner Henry Miller.
So let me turn around the question of whether you listen to music while you write. Do you listen to music while you read, if you're just reading a book for yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have music on?
I do. Again, I prefer wordless music when I'm reading, but I do.
And mostly the classics?
Mm-hmm.
So the third piece in your pick three for us today is Beethoven, which would seem to have little connection to the book, except that there is a little kind of left turn off the narrative that takes us there.
Yeah, the only way I could write about the Violette Morris, Lou Villar character was to write about her through constructing a kind of bogus biography of her being written by a highly neurotic French high school teacher. A friend of mine said when he read that section, he could see the nicotine stains between her fingers, which made me so happy. Anyway, at some point, as the story gets darker and darker, as Lou's story gets darker, the biographer has more and more trouble, A, not talking about herself and her own problems, and B, dealing with the material. So at one point she says every time she starts writing, she hears the sound of a stone falling down a well. So she goes to a psychiatrist. First she goes to a neurologist who says there's nothing wrong with her. And then she goes to a psychiatrist who suggests that she listen to Beethoven's late quartets, which actually got into the novel because I was listening to it. I mean, that was sort of backwards. I had been listening to it. I mean, I was obsessed with the late quartets for about 3 months while I was working. It just so, you know, I knew them before, but I became obsessed. So it was a way of listening to it and working into the novel and not having to stop listening to it because I was working it into the novel.
And with perhaps one really notable exception, the Holy Prayer of Convalescence, or however you want to translate that, the late quartets of Beethoven are full of Sturm und Drang.
I know, and dark, dark, dark.
Yeah. So which one did you pick for us?
I picked number 15.
So the Beethoven String Quartet, number 15 in A minor. We have a recording here by the Belsea Quartet. And that'll wrap up Francine Prose's pick three. She's the author of the new book, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It is out now. And Francine, it's been a lot of fun kind of weaving music in amongst the many threads of this book.
Thanks. Thank you so much. It was great fun.
First movement of the Beethoven Quartet, number 15 in A minor, opus 132, performed here by the Belsea Quartet and picked by our guest Francine Prose, author of the novel Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. Up next, live music from Casey Dinell, who performs as White Hinterland, and later a conversation with the band Perfect Pussy. This is Soundcheck.
Sun's about up, and I'm on one, digging my feet down into the sand.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Musicians on this show have often talked about how getting out of your comfort zone is an important way to create work that's fresh and surprising. Sometimes that means something as simple as switching out an electric guitar for an acoustic one. But for Casey Dinell, who records under the name White Hinterland, getting out of her comfort zone meant making some pretty big decisions. She scrapped an early version of her next album, moved back to her old hometown, and built a studio in her parents' basement. The record that came out of it is called Baby, and Casey is here to play some songs from it, live in our Soundcheck studio. The first one is called David. This is White Hinterland, live on Soundcheck.
You wanna know the time of roads all paved with all certainty. I can see.
That is White Hinterland, the work of Casey Dinell, who you heard singing and playing our piano here in the Soundcheck studio, and her song called David, which appears on the new White Hinterland record called Baby, which is out now. Casey, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please tell me that's not an autobiographical song.
I wish it wasn't, but...
Did you really go running at someone with your sharpest knife?
Well, you know, it's important to be prepared for anything.
Apparently so. I mean, this album is full of, I mean, there's a real kind of intensity to a lot of these lyrics, it seems. Mm-hmm. You know, people dealing with, you know, is it chance? Are there accidents? You know, what kind of agency do we have in our own lives? They're kind of big questions,
all
it seems.
All the meaty stuff.
So no surprise then that maybe this didn't flow so easily, this record.
No, I think naming it Baby was probably the first indication that it wasn't going to be easy.
Yeah. So there was at least one false start making this record, right?
Two, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is like the third version, the final
So what changed? What was the missing ingredient?
Chutzpah. I think the biggest was moving back to Scituate because...
Scituate, Massachusetts?
Scituate, Mass.
Is that a suburb of Boston?
It is. I mean, suburb is generous. It's very
So it's an exurb.
Small. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So moving back there, what did that give you? How did that provide the breakthrough?
Well, zero distraction because I built the studio and I actually wasn't, at that point, I'd kind of given up on the idea that the record was ever going to happen.
So you built your own studio and then produced the thing yourself.
Yeah, I'd never done that by myself. I'd never been the only person in the studio while working. And I think that lack of self-consciousness, like no need for a filter and allowing me to try things out with my voice or lyrically that maybe I would have kind of second-guessed if someone had been around.
Now, you've studied both classical composition and you studied with Dominique Ayad. You studied singing with a great singer up in New England.
Phenomenal singer.
So, you know, you've got kind of like a grounding in the kind of the techniques, the foundation that you need to do all this stuff.
It's a good toolkit.
But at some point, you know, you have to kind of get into your own toolkit, I suppose.
Yeah. The hardest thing is finding your voice. It's really true. And I think it's very rare that you start out that way. And I think double the time that you were in school is what it takes to get the school out, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So talking about finding your own voice, when you started recording, it was as Casey Dinell.
Mm-hmm.
And then you started recording as White Hinterland.
Mm-hmm.
Did that signal some kind of change in your career and your self-expression somehow?
It started sort of as a persona, but I don't think it is anymore. I mean, I think they've completely merged. It's weird how something as simple as a name change will allow me to be more myself and kind of say what I feel like. Or I think there's a few lyrics on the record where it sounds like how I talk, which I don't know if that's a good thing, but just some like kind of direct, bold expressions.
That sounds all right. Casey Dinell is White Hinterland, and the new album is called Baby. It is out now. You played the first song on our piano, but you've also brought your keyboard in.
My Nord.
Your Nord, which, you know, the record is full of textures, layers of sound. And so, I mean, this is just you, but we'll get a little more of a sense of that, I suppose, in this next song. Ring the Bell is the next one?
Yes.
All right, let's hear it. Casey Dinell here in the Soundcheck studio.
Oh,
That's called Ring the Bell. It's live music in the soundcheck studio from White Hinterland, which is the work of Casey Dinell, singer, songwriter, keyboardist. Casey, it's been great having you with us here in the soundcheck studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The man.
Up next, the band Perfect Pussy was a featured performer on this year's NPR Music Stage at the South by Southwest Music Festival. We'll talk with two members of the group about noise rock, touring, and yes, their infamous band name. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Recently, the hardcore punk band Perfect Pussy joined us here in the studio. The Syracuse Five piece is led by singer Meredith Graves, and they released their debut album called Say Yes to Love earlier this year, and they've been touring pretty much nonstop ever since. Now, in addition to bringing their instruments to our studio, the band also brought me a pair of earplugs, and in just a minute, you'll hear why I was glad to have them. The band played a blistering 5-minute set, which you can hear and watch in its entirety at soundcheck.org. Here's just a taste.
I have never taken a wedding of my family.
Band Perfect Pussy with their song Advance Upon the Real, played live here in the Soundcheck studio. After they played that song, and after I removed the earplugs they'd given me, I sat down with band members Sean Sutkus and singer Meredith Graves, who was in fact singing slash screaming actual lyrics during that song we just heard. Pretty poetic ones, actually, about love and desire, power and fear. So I started out by asking her why the band buries those words into the mix.
Well, I tend to see the lyrics and their actual vocalization as being two different components to the band. Reading along with hardcore records is something that I've been doing since I was a kid. And there are as many different styles as there are of hardcore music. One general continuum through them is that the lyrics can be unintelligible because of the way the singers choose to vocalize. So never having had the opportunity to sing in a straightforward hardcore band, as straightforward as this band is, it was something I wanted to experiment with. I found I always listened more closely when I was reading along. I'm big into reading. And also because on the flip side of that, it's more egalitarian to me when I'm less of a front person and more of an instrument, which is another reason why Sean, Ray, Greg, and I are always kind of in the front of the stage together during a live performance, is because I like the idea that it is four incredibly talented people and me up on stage all at the same time. And it's kind of like a circus, you know, you don't really know where to look. Yeah. There's a ballerina on an elephant and the elephant is balancing a ball and there's a clown riding under the elephant. And I want it to be that confusing visually. So.
Have we lost that? With digital files where you don't have the lyrics and people are just kind of listening and can't read along.
Well, in a way, I think that's nice too. But you can ask me anything, and I'll tell you it's all nice. I'm a pretty agreeable human being. There's also something to be said for being confused in a world that's a little too accessible. Hmm. You can Google nearly anything you want. Well, I heard something great recently, which is if a time traveler from the 1950s came back and saw smartphones, they would think that we had a device that fit in our pocket that was capable of explaining to us all of human history and all the knowledge accessible to humans, and then they would see that we use it to pick fights with strangers and look at pictures of cats. And they would get really angry. So maybe inaccessibility is kind of a cool thing.
We're speaking with the members of the Syracuse band Perfect Pussy. You mentioned Meredith being on the road for 4 months. You guys played South by Southwest. You were part of the NPR showcase. Were you guys playing the night of that terrible car accident that took four lives?
We were.
Where were you?
We were a block away from, we were at Stubbs. That's where our show was, and we left Stubbs, and then the accident had just happened, and we kind of walked by everything, and we're kind of looking.
How soon were you on the scene?
I saw people getting, like, CPR and stuff like that. We were right there. It had just happened to the point where I was like, we should walk away from this because, you know, we're not going to help anybody and we need to, it appeared as if the person was still, like, on the loose or whatever. So we got out of there as fast as possible.
You mean the driver?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what did that do to the atmosphere of the festival?
It made you question your reason for being there.
It made us question our reasons for being there.
Yeah.
That was the problem with the entire situation, is that by our show was at the Mohawk the next morning, and thankfully it was canceled, and we were really happy about that because we didn't feel it was appropriate. Mm-hmm. But by the third day, I said this to a friend, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. By the third day, I was seeing people finishing cans of beer and throwing them on the ground and littering on the intersection where people had died 48 hours before. And that was when I said to myself, I never, ever, ever want to go to a music festival again. Mm. It sucked.
So it wasn't all the corporate branding and stuff. It was. It seems like the enduring memory of South By for 2014 is going to be that tragedy.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I think Greg made a really good point when he was talking about his feelings, Greg, our bass player, talking about his feelings about the festival, that was what kind of exemplified it for him too, was the fact that it just seemed like people had forgotten about it already, like it was problematic. I want the memory of this year because, as he had said to me and to the rest of our band, the fact that the accident happened was a direct result of the festival. The two were inextricably linked. It didn't feel like a fluke. The two were connected.
Mm. So on to a happier touring note. I mean, you guys have been all over the place. What town surprised you? Where did you go in thinking, we'll do a show, and it turned out to be like an awesome place and an awesome crowd?
McAllen, Texas was the greatest city in the world. It's a border town right on the border of Texas and Mexico, and they have a big festival every year called the Galaxy Fair.
Uh-huh.
And we went and played with Creaturas and Power Trip.
I was so confused. I thought you were talking about Marfa. I'm like,
no,
that wasn't that good.
No, McAllen. They have a festival every year in McAllen, and bands come from all over the country and some from over the world. And there's two locations this year. There was a nightclub called La Bruja Luna that was doing a punk show, and then across the street at the famous, 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 historically super important Cine del Rey. They had the bigger shows over there. And the people we met were absolutely amazing, our friends Edgar and Andy and Patrick and everyone that was down there. The other bands that played were amazing. Learning about the history of McAllen, Texas, and the history of the Cine del Rey and the scene down there, absolutely amazing. The reception we received was incredible, and I think we've stayed in good touch with the people we've met there. I cannot wait to go back. I want to see my friend Edgar. I miss him a lot.
That seems to be part of, you know, people who are outside the hardcore scene have this kind of image of it being a sort of bristling, unfriendly group of people. There's a real sense of community within the scene. I mean, what you're saying, Meredith, is not surprising, you know, to anybody who's ever traveled at all in that circuit.
True. But you have to be very careful because, at least in my experience, yes, I want to agree with you. And experiences like McAllen make me say, yes, absolutely, the hardcore scene, there is a community. There are people that have each other's backs. Great. 3/4 of the experiences I've had in the hardcore scene have absolutely disproved that.
Is that because you are a woman?
Entirely possible. It's also because I...
That is one thing.
That is a key component. Yeah. I am also a notorious pain in the ass, which might also color my experiences in the hardcore scene, that I am an easily unlikable human being. That might also color my experiences. I have to admit that.
Now, let me ask... how annoying is it that, you know, some great publications like the New York Times will talk about your music and not mention the name of your band?
I don't care.
I don't mind.
I don't care at all.
I don't really care. It's their problem, not mine.
And yet, you
seems
know,
like they have something they need to work on.
Well, article after article about Pussy Riot, but.
If we did anything 1/18th as great as what Pussy Riot's done for the world, I would be butthurt about it. But since we haven't done anything even remotely approximating that, I will just be happy that there was a picture of me on the New York Times website. I could send that to my mom and she clapped and everyone felt great. I could care less. I don't care what they call our band. Oh. I do not.
Now, Meredith, you did an interview with Toby Vail from Bikini Kill where she interviewed you.
Yeah.
For the website Wondering Sound.
Yes.
Well, I mean, were you a Riot girl as a youngster?
No, not at all.
So what was that like for you?
I
mean, you talked before about learning the history. I mean, certainly that's a musical history you must be pretty familiar with now.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a really small town, so a lot of my early access to punk in a city where there was no scene was reading historical books about it. My dad's a big reader. He's a big music listener, and he always provided me with, you know, Lex McNeil and Greil Marcus, and there were all these histories of, like, In the Fascist Bathroom and England's Dreaming and all these huge books that were a historiography of Western punk and then the UK punk. But two things I never really learned about were the totally non-homogenous history of women in punk and the history of punk globally. And there were texts that have been published within the last 10 years about Riot Girl, scholarly texts. And so I did start reading about it then. I did listen to it a little in high school. But Riot Girl, for how important it was historically, also was a scene that served like 50 people in two cities and was really focused on cisgender women, white women, privilege, like women with a certain amount of privileges. I don't want to downplay its importance to the history of music, mm-hmm. but when modern bands like us and other bands get compared to being Riot Girl bands, that's kind of like calling contemporary bands grunge bands. That happened 20 right. years ago.
Right.
We need to create a new history for punk that involves women and non-male people so we don't have to keep returning to terms that went out of cultural fashion 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, now let me, you know, you mentioned the use of terms. Now, you've used both non-male and cisgender.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, how we're in kind of a state of flux, it seems, with our language, mm-hmm. with the way we approach gender.
Hopefully.
So for folks who are not familiar with the term cisgender.
Cisgender people are people whose biological birth assignation matches up with the gender they experience life through. The idea, it's awful that I'm on the radio right now. If you point at your head, mm-hmm. think gender. If you point between your legs, say sex. Mm-hmm. Your sex and your gender are not the same thing. Cisgender refers to a person whose head and pelvis line up along the same lines. And when I say the term non-male people, what I mean to clarify is non-cis male people. I'm not necessarily including trans men or non-binary men when I make that statement. I'm specifically talking about cisgender men.
So, you know, once you get into that sort of thing, I mean, the problem becomes how do you kind of spread, how do you not make it into another thicket of jargon that is, you know, difficult for outsiders to sort of get into and be part of?
Well, speaking in a way that normalizes it, being willing to explain your terms and using it as another key component of language that's imperative to the everyday survival of people to whom those terms are extraordinarily important. Mm-hmm. Basically, meeting the basic standards of human decency.
Good. Well said.
Pretty easy.
The band is Perfect Pussy. Their album is called Say Yes to Love. It is out now. It's got to be, what, 22, 23 minutes, Sean?
It's exactly 23 minutes long.
23 minutes.
Yeah.
And yet it is sort of a complete statement from the band, it seems.
Yes. Yeah.
What happens next?
We're going to go travel the world and hopefully have some great experiences along the way.
Meredith, you looking at this for the long haul? Or
no, I have to get a wisdom tooth out next week, so we'll see if I live through that first.
All right. Now, Meredith, you recently wrote a piece for Rock Torch, another website, about Cool Keith's album Black Elvis Lost in
My
Space.
Favorite. Yeah, I love Cool Keith. I love Cool Keith.
Well, what is it? First of all, when did you kind of stumble upon this record?
When I was in college. It was my first trip out to the West Coast with my then partner. I met a friend of his in the Pacific Northwest who was a sex worker who had done a show with Cool Keith, who had danced on stage with him, and was over the moon about the fact that she was in his top 8 on MySpace at the time. So I had heard Dr. Octagonecologist, and she...
Which was his better-known record
to that point. But then in 1999, he did this album called Black Elvis Lost in Space, and when I went to sort of investigate more of his work to sort of... Because she was so cool, I was like, I want to do everything this woman does. She's so rad and just like... strong. I said, okay, I'm going to go listen to Cool Keith. And for whatever reason, I picked up Black Elvis. And the way that he uses words on that record, there is not another record like that in existence in the course of history. Every time I hear it, I catch something new, and it makes me so happy.
Actually, let's hear a little bit from Cool Keith and Lost in Space. We've been speaking with and listening to the members of the Syracuse band Perfect Pussy. And to the five of you, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us and playing for us.
Thanks for having
us.
Ready on the left. Metric bypass, don't use on overload retrace, cause we're
lost in space.
Metric bypass, don't use on overload retrace, cause we're
lost in space.
Metric bypass, don't use on overload retrace, cause we're
lost in space.
Flash bulletin, keep still solo with no manager. Time clock out.
We're always interested to hear your feedback about this or any other episode of Soundcheck. You can leave us a message at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or send us an email, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff with Amy Pearl. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time. This is Soundcheck.